Welcome back to the MolePigs podcast. I'm Eric. Today on the podcast, we're doing something slightly different. The Molecular Programming Society is organizing what they're calling the Molecular Programming Flight Plan. Because not everybody's able to join at the physical meeting in Seattle, they asked if we could facilitate some international conversations around the theme of collaboration. Over the next two episodes, I'll be facilitating panel discussions with an international group of researchers on this theme, kind of meant as a stand-in for a conference panel. But first, I would like to welcome Dominic Scalise to the podcast, who will introduce us to the project. Dominic, welcome.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me on MolePigs. I'm really excited to be here. And it's nice to have the structures in place like MolePigs to kind of facilitate these conversations. So I really appreciate this.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess I should say welcome back because this is your second time on the podcast, right?
True. Yeah, I joined one of the early ones.
So great to have you back. So what exactly is a decadal flight plan, as you're calling this meeting?
Yeah. Our goal here is to see if we can bring together representation from across the community to outline where we are right now as a field for molecular programming, where we want to be in 10 years, the decadal part, and see if it's possible to break that down into individual actionable steps to get from point A where we are to point B where we want to be in 10 years as a field. If we're successful in outlining that, I think that is the flight plan. There will be a document we'll share publicly after we've gone through this process. But if we're successful, then we want to pursue that as well. Currently, we're on that part where we say point A, point B, how do we break down the steps to get to some of those goals?
As far as I understand, in addition to it being a 10-year plan, there are also kind of 10 committees. Do you want to tell us about what some of the topics that you've kind of broken down the field into and broken down the goal setting into?
So there are 10 committees. There are three types of committees. The first three are basic sciences. And this is looking at things like self-assembly, dynamic structures. That's the first committee. So here we're going to be addressing questions of how large of structure can we build right now? What do we expect to be able to build in 10 years? Can we do composite structures? What are our needs for structural self-assembly? And can we project where we're going to be and accelerate that process? The second committee is on circuits. What can we compute? Can we scale up what we compute? Can we compute for longer or faster? The third one is really exciting, which is interfaces. This is our last of the basic sciences. And this is saying, okay, we've got structures and circuits. Now we can we connect those to other materials? There are many existing libraries of interfaces, aptamers, activatable toeholds, a bunch of different ways where the inputs and outputs of structures and circuits can sense and control other materials. So we're looking at that. Those are our three basic sciences. Next, we have the category of applications. So we'd like to keep pushing molecular programming towards something that is relevant outside of just academic labs. It's really exciting to play around with it here as well. But can we keep pushing it farther? So some of the applications we're going to be exploring during the flight plan are programmable medicine. Can we use these structures, circuits, and interfaces to do intelligent medicines? That'll look at issues currently of biostability. How long can these last in biological environments? And then also, what diagnostics can we do? What outputs? Can we release drugs? Can we do virus traps? Looking at those where we are again, where we want those to go. That's one of the big applications. We're also going to have three more. One is on DNA data storage, or rather molecular data storage. We also want to bring in, though, the in-solution processing for data storage. So not just we synthesize and sequence DNA to store it and read it out, but also can we search for things? I think the canonical example is like, can you search for cat emojis in your solution and only read those ones instead of everything else? Looking at that, because that ties back into the circuits and interfaces quite a bit right there. Two more are molecular readout. So right now, it's hard to get more than one or two signals often out of a lot of these systems. Can we get 1 or 2 million signals coming out of them? Can we get spatially relevant ones? So we'll be looking at things kind of like nanopores and DNA paint types of questions where we can get a lot more information. That could be considered basic science, but I think industry is also really interested in that as an application. So it kind of straddles both of them. And then the last application area that we're looking at, we're calling hybrid devices. And this is connecting structures, circuits, interfaces, but now seeing, can we build information processing devices that are not just one type of material, but could you use DNA origami to scaffold the creation of electronics or photonics? Could you insert non-canonical amino acids or XNAs into biological gene networks? And how does that work when you start to mix some of these things together? Again, that could be considered basic science or applications. We're putting it on applications right now. So that's our applications area. There's some other exciting ones, but those are four that we think are ready to really blossom. So we'd like to push them forward if we can. And then we got one more category, which is our more administrative or strategic level committees. These are not science. This is not research. But trying to see, can we re-envision how we're doing science in order to really scale up and take advantage of the fact that our community is still really tiny and really close-knit, really easy to chat with anyone in the field and do some larger things because of that close-knit community. So the first one of those three is our industry partnership. This will bring in folks from, there's a myriad of molecular programming startups, bringing in those CEOs, those founders, and staff scientists on those, bringing in Microsoft, bringing other larger companies in, and having academia all sit down and talk to each other and say, can we build structures that really knit these together that give us advantages in both cases, not just ignore basic sciences and do things industry wants and not just ask industry for money, which is a lot of the kind of jaded view of how those might have gone in the past for other fields. But can we build structures that are really productive for both? So one that I'm really excited by is can we have a pathway for PhD students to have internships at companies, build those connections, learn what industry needs, come back, do some more studies, finish up their PhD, and then kind of have an industry plan, a pathway ahead of them where they can get a job that's really exciting to them and that they're really well prepared for. I think that would benefit both sides. There's a lot of other things there we're excited by. The ninth committee, which I'll be on, is tasked with identifying structures for large-scale collaborations. So this would be the follow-up committee. If the whole flight plan is successful, we have this beautiful document, how do we actually put it into practice? How do we pursue it together? And this will look at things like how do we share data across many institutions? How do we get many people from many different time zones to divide up a research project in a way that actually can be productive rather than just frustrating? And we'll pull from ideas from some of the ways that MolPigs and the Molecular Programming Society are doing these grassroots structures rather than just single lab or dimer lab structures. The last one is looking at international partnership. And here, that's the committee that you'll be leading here. That's trying to say, can we find new ways to collaborate internationally so that there aren't these intercontinental divides? I think some continents have it together with collaborations between countries, but it gets really hard when you're in multiple different time zones. So can we break that tyranny of the time zone in and really bring together these committees? There's these communities. There's a big one in Europe, as you obviously know. There's a big one in the United States, as you know. You've straddled both of those, and also a big one over in Asia. Can we connect those three together? I'd like to turn it back to you.
Yeah, and this is really exciting, kind of as an early career researcher. I feel like we are at something of an inflection point in the community, because for a long time, like, you could get really high impact papers and people would really like think what you were doing was super cool if you just made a new structure that nobody had ever seen before. Mm-hmm. And I think we're kind of toward the end of where that's possible. And at this point, people are asking a lot of like, okay, so what? And like, there is something that like initially drew me to the field of like, you can make this, that is so beautiful and cool. But at the same time, you know, we do have to move towards something interesting. So I think this is a really good initiative to, you know, get people to think a little bit bigger and not just think on the scale of, okay, what can I do in a 2-year PhD project? And instead like have that integrated in something bigger.
Right.
So like, I'm really excited to work on this.
I'd like to amplify that a little bit and say what guides me here, and maybe it's useful to the community, maybe it's not.
Go for it.
There is always like, we all want that next science paper. That's really exciting. But to me, what's driving this is I want to see molecular programming or programmable matter more broadly become a mainstream technology in our lifetimes. And our lifetimes are really quite short. So if you project where we're going to be on the current path, we're probably not going to see the fruits of all these exciting technologies unless we do some things really radically different to accelerate. And I think MolePigs, the flight plan, some of the other grassroots community efforts are looking at ways, can we change business as usual to have a chance at seeing these results? I'm using that as a guiding light more than, can I get one more science paper out of this?
I think that's a really healthy thing for the community and a healthy perspective on science in general. Do you have anything else you want to add before I throw this over to our first committee meeting?
I do have five things I'd like to see come out of the international community. And I apologize for taking more time than we had planned.
Go for it.
One, any creative things. So that's great. Do whatever you want to do. I'm excited to hear anything. And I think you and I have talked through some of these already. So these aren't just my ideas. A lot of these are your ideas. A lot of these are community ideas. But when I try to categorize them, first, I'd really love to see some sort of community web structure that spans the continents. So this is something I think you suggested, but having a representative in each participant lab that can perhaps be like a MolePigs representative and that can meet routinely a few times a year and talk about things that are important globally within molecular programming, talk about long-term vision, talk about current research goals, things like that. I'd love to see a more formalized network or structure. That's one. Two, I'd love to see some cohesion or coherency about what are our shared large level visions, something like a list of global grand challenges that we're wanting to pursue together. If we can articulate those, then we can start to build some collaborations to pursue them. But if each continent or each country, you know, has their own interests and we're not really talking to each other about what those are, it's harder to communicate. Third, I'd love to see some sort of natural research infrastructure that's really easy to export across global distances. And I think you mentioned this as well. Software is a really easy way for us to, we're all building it in our different labs. It's easy for us to package it up and get it out to other labs, and that can facilitate some more collaboration, I think relatively easily that we're not doing right now. So sharing some research tools, particularly software. Two more things I'd like to see are some mechanism, if we had funding, we don't right now, currently here at least, but if we did, what would we want to do for more physical researcher mobility? Could we have some sort of official mechanism for sending visiting scholars for a year between labs, between continents? That would be really exciting to me, and I think would help the communication and help, you know, career prospects as well. If you have a broader network, you've got more options afterwards. And then lastly, I'd love to see some collaboration on policy coordination. So this would be looking at ways to pursue joint funding calls. There are some opportunities that require different countries to work together. I think we're ripe for some of those opportunities, but also looking at white papers, reaching out to journalists to tell them what we're doing and what some of these big initiatives are. Coordinating on some policy for education. So we're working on this grassroots textbook, The Art of Molecular Programming, which I'm not going to go into right now, but could we find ways to be working towards curriculums that we think are exciting across different cultures and different continents would be exciting as well. So that's some of the more policy and strategic level. I'd love to see those five things. Anything else that comes out, I'm excited. I know you're going to lead a really nice committee. So thanks for doing this, Eric.
Thank you. And I should say that we recorded this interview after we recorded the first committee meeting. And you will hear many of those themes head on in the following discussion. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you for joining us, Dominic.
Thanks. Bye.
And now, over to the committee. Welcome, everybody, to the first committee meeting. I would like to start today with a quick introduction round. Who are you? Where are you? And what are your research interests? Quentin, let's start with you.
So my name is Quentin. I'm a postdoc researcher right now in France, and before that in Canada in Hannity Sleeman's lab. And I'm setting up a group as a PI in France starting this fall. My research interests lie basically at the interface of DNA nanotech and supramolecular chemistry in general, also including peptides and other biomolecules to probe biological questions in general.
Let's go with Emily next.
Hello, everyone. So I'm Emily, and I'm just finished my PhD, or in the process of finishing my PhD in Kurt Gotthelf's group in Aarhus University in Denmark. And I'm interested in using origami and DNA nanotechnology for programming functions. So that can range from delivery systems or biosensing and more.
And let's hear from Ibuki next.
So hi, everybody. I'm Ibuki Kawamata. So I'm now an associate professor in Kyoto University. I just became associate professor last year. Before that, I was in Tohoku University and as an assistant professor. So my research field is basically DNA computing. I use DNA to design molecular scale robot-like objects, and I do some DNA computing for reaction diffusion or pattern formation type reaction. I also do a little bit simulation of DNA nanotechnology. So yeah, that's what I do.
And finally, Masahiro.
Hi, I'm Masahiro Takinoe. I'm a professor in the Institute of Science, Tokyo, Japan. So my background is the biophysics. So then I'm studying especially the molecular computing. So I'm interested in the application of the DNA condensate to the study of the molecular computing. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. It's really exciting to have you as a part of the panel. So on to our first question for the panel. Kind of what are your experiences with collaborating either just between labs or especially internationally? What has the collaboration been good for? What would you like to see better? And kind of moving into the future, what is like a dream team of collaborators that you'd like to see? What are the capabilities you'd like to see put together? Or what is something that you've seen that has worked really, really well that you'd love to see more of in the future? Go ahead, Quentin.
Yeah, sure, I'll go. So in my case, I think like where I really enjoyed the power of collaboration is through the exchange of students that are not basically from a given field and going into a lab where the expertise is really different where they come from. We've had the case when I was in Hannity Sleeman's lab of many exchange students coming based on very different backgrounds of supramolecular chemistry and learning how to do DNA nanotech in general. And that was also my case when I started as a postdoc fellow in her lab. And that really helps like learning a ton of new things and especially bringing a new perspective into the field from a more like chemistry-oriented point of view rather than the material, which I think was really valuable in a lot of cases.
And Ibuki, it looks like you have something as well.
So yeah, I was for CMU lab for 1 year and doing, I was originally a theoretician or computer scientist, but it was good experience, learning experience there. I also see Pekka Urponen from Finland, who is a theoretician, keeping a collaboration work was very good. But the problem was that, I just have 1 year, but you know, it's very interdisciplinary. So if you start learning something, 1 year is not very enough. So having a very continuous collaboration sounds, I hope I have some more collaborations, and we're also in Japan, so sometimes it's not very easy to communicate, or I of course welcome you if somebody's coming to Kyoto, but you know, the distance is very far, so sometimes it can be a barrier we like to overcome some way.
And have you maintained those collaborations with Fritz and with Pekka after you went back to Japan?
Yeah. I visited them like in 2017, but our paper finally comes out in 2022 or something. Like it was 5 years of collaboration. I just stayed 1 year, but I have extra 4 years to communicate. But there was a lot of constraint also. So I'd like to know how the experience of other people too.
And especially for those of you who are PIs or are about to become PIs, what are the kind of capabilities you would love to send your group members out to learn from other labs? This can be there's something that you learned or something that you wish that you had had a chance to learn during your studies. Go ahead, Ibuki.
So yeah, in my case, there's several students who are interested in studying abroad. I really push them to contact, or if necessary, I can somehow bridge some other professors to visit. Especially, like Fritz Simmel, he is a very international person, so I always ask him to be one candidate. But I don't know, at least some Japanese students are sometimes not very positive to go abroad, or sometimes like funding become a problem, or it's not very common in Japan to take a gap year for internship or things like that. So this kind of difference of system become a barrier, but I really want to encourage students to go abroad or study abroad, a kind of exchange of technology, yeah.
I've got a lot more questions about the kind of structures of how to send people later, but first, like you say, you really like sending people to Fritz's lab. Like, what is it about his lab that makes it a good place to send students to?
Other researchers, I think, is also a very good lab. But in my experience, it was very interdisciplinary. Like his lab is biophysics lab, but people come from engineering, some people come from chemistry, some people are theoreticians, physicians, a physicist, yeah. And they're also international group. Like, you know, it's not just research, but culture-wise, it was also a good experience. But I think in the United States, it's also the same.
Interesting, thank you. Masahiro?
So in my case, my laboratory also send my student to the international laboratories. So in my case, if the students visit the main laboratories, we can make the strong connection between the main laboratories, and also we can learn the interesting knowledge that we don't have yet before. So such opportunity is very good for the laboratory. And also after the sending the students, I also can visit and discuss a lot, and also that we can make the strong connection between the laboratories. It's a very good opportunity because the Japanese university are a bit far from the Europe and the US. So in the case of the DNA computing the field, there are many the good laboratories in the UK and Europe also. So that we would like to know how they make the direction of this field. So such kind of the discussion is very important for us. So the sending and visiting the laboratory is a very good opportunity for us. Especially the Japanese government is now pushing such an opportunity for the student and also the faculty researchers.
So what you're saying is it's really not just about the techniques, but it's also about this perspective, right, that we can get from.
Mm-hmm. Yes, knowledge also and technique also, but the connection is very important because if we make the connection, we can learn the technique more, and also we can also tell them our knowledge too.
Very interesting. Go ahead, Quentin.
Yeah, in terms of maybe more technical point of view and dream team of lab capabilities, one thing that I've found quite hard is bridging the gap between experimentalists and theoreticians. Sometimes we do speak the same language, but not always. And there's a steep learning curve, I would say, of learning how to collaborate that I've so far not really managed to pass above. It's really, really difficult to get started in, well, from my point of view, going into theories and modeling and computing of whatever DNA nanostructure that we can think of. So it's something that I would like to see facilitated somehow. I don't have a good answer of how, but somehow. And that's something that would really benefit everyone.
And kind of on the flip side of this question, is there anything that you think that your lab would do a really good job of teaching other people how to use? I can think maybe Quentin, you have might have some good examples here of how we can use DNA synthesizers in very creative ways that maybe the people who work in pure DNA wouldn't think about.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's something that I really learned in Hanadi's lab, of really hijacking the chemistry of DNA synthesis on a synthesizer to incorporate new moieties, new languages, if I would say, by incorporating, for example, other supramolecular chemistry tricks into that, other moieties that also self-assemble but through different ways. And that's something that also has a really huge learning curve, because you need organic chemistry background for that. But it's something that a lot of people are afraid of, but it's not the worst to learn how to do in the lab, to make modified phosphoramidites and incorporate them into a DNA strand. It is some work to learn, but you can learn in, for a PhD student, in an exchange of 2-3 months, you can learn how to do that. And that really opens a toolbox that not a lot of people have accessible, and that is extremely fun to work with.
So we touched on it a little bit in this last section, but what are kind of some of the practical constraints that you've run into? I know Ibuki and Emily, you two have both done a lot of moving around between different labs. Like, what are the stupid logistical things where you were kind of saying yourself, like, this shouldn't be a problem? If you want to share anything that's blocked your path. Go ahead, Emily.
So maybe not something that blocked my path, but you know, there are definitely things that you need to think about, like, where am I going to stay if I go to another country to work in a different lab? What type of equipment do they have, and kind of like the system of like how their lab works and stuff like this? I think it's just things that you don't really consider until, you know, the moment is there and you have to think about it. But I think also in terms of, like, for PhD students at least, also considering, for example, like, when do you want to do the collaboration? Like, you know, if a PhD student also has to teach and wants to go to a conference, you know, of course, if you go abroad to do a collaboration, you want to spend all of your time doing that, and you have to really fit it in within the schedule. So I think those are just things that people have to consider and maybe not think about at the time when you think, oh, I have a great project idea, you know.
Is there any time that's, like, particularly good to do that? Or is it just everybody's different, everybody's on a different schedule? Maybe like early PhD, late PhD, postdoc, like, when do people have time to go abroad?
Yeah, so in Aarhus University, at least, our PhDs are split into two. So we do a part A and a part B, and it's literally like split in the middle. And a lot of people decide to focus fully on, you know, teaching or doing their projects in their part A. And once they do this kind of mini thesis and defense, then they can spend more time into looking where they can do some stuff abroad. And I think actually a lot of students decide to do their collaboration right at the end of their PhD. So especially if you're thinking of doing a project that's a bit different to other projects that you've done for the rest of your PhD, and it's just to, you know, learn something new. So I notice a lot of students do that, but I decided to split my exchange abroad into two parts. So I did like 1.5 months at the during my part A and 1.5 months during my part B. And I really based that on how well the project was working. So in the first 1.5 months, it was kind of like seeing if we can get a proof of concept. If it worked, then we can continue. If it didn't work, then we can just drop it. So I think it really depends on a case-to-case basis.
Quentin?
So yeah, I agree. It's really case-to-case. I don't think there's general answer, but once you become some faculty member, there's so many stupid, I won't say stupid, but there's many duties So they don't allow us to even go for several months. That's just 1 week or 2 weeks is just possible. So yeah, I really encourage going in early stage PhD or master course, doctor course. Yeah, in my case, I was very lucky that I have a kind of sabbatical 1 year in my early stage, so it was very nice. I also see a lot of European people who do an internship visiting for a few months, like let's say two to three months. It's a very good, I find it's a very good strategy to start a collaboration. It's still very short to do a big project, but to start with, to have a collaboration or connection, I find it's a very good system.
Yeah, this is something we have a lot of in Europe. So in the lab that I'm a part of, we get usually master's students in for 3 months at a time, and then sometimes for a longer one if they're, you know, a thesis student. But we also get a fair number of PhD students who kind of come in from elsewhere to use our equipment, and we'll send people out either because they have some sort of expertise that they don't have, or we're like working on a paper together. But this is really, I think, facilitated a lot by the fact that Europe is very interconnected. There's a lot of collaboration bonds, and there's this like overall structure of the ERC, which kind of leads into my next question, which is what sort of funding and facilitation are available either from your university or from your funding agencies? Somebody mentioned a little bit earlier that the Japanese government has gotten very into funding these international stays. What does that look like? And how is that different than, for example, the Marie Curie program that Emily was a part of? Maybe we'll go ahead and start with Emily. And can you kind of describe what the Marie Curie program provides, what it doesn't provide, and what it let you do that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to?
Yeah, so the Marie Curie program is, it's just a, I guess, funding program, and there's a lot of students involved depending on this overall project idea. So in my case, we were called the Consens Consortium because we were all interested in improving continuous biosensing systems, and there were 15 PhD students involved in this consortium, and all of us were, you know, we had the goal of improving continuous biosensors, but we approached it in different ways. Some people wanted to really look at the biosensing part and improve like the protein interactions and these type of nanoswitches, or others were more interested in the readout part, like optics and all of this stuff. And I think the really nice thing that the Marie Curie does is that we had really regular meetings, right? We had regular in-person meetings every 6 months, and we would go and visit each other's universities, and we would have I think it was a few days up to a week of lectures, visiting the facilities, looking around their labs, and then all of the students gave a project update about what they've been doing in the last 6 months. And having these type of meetings really allowed us to get a deeper understanding of what everyone does, what everyone's expertise is, maybe where expertise is needed in their group, and also the facilities available, and what if we were to visit, do a collaboration with them, what really is possible. And in between these 6 months meetings, we also had online webinars where the students gave a update as well. So we really had a in-depth knowledge of what everyone was doing, and things like this. But within the Marie Curie, it's also like we had to do some time abroad in each other's lab. We could decide where we wanted to go. We could also find another group or another company if we were interested in visiting there too. But we had to kind of do this exchange. But I think having these meetings really allowed us to kind of just discuss more, to see what was you know, possible, what we're interested in as well, and how we could help each other. And I think that having this network of people was really nice for that.
Did that network kind of help inform your next steps of what you're going to do after your PhD at all?
Like how so?
Like did it inspire either, you know, industry things you've applied for or postdocs you've applied for?
Yeah, so I think it was also nice because within the Mercury system that I was in, that we had to both do academic exchange and also an industrial exchange. So you really got to see both sides of it. And I think, I guess it does influence your choice in some way because you really can see what's available out there, right?
Nice. And one last question about that. From kind of the funding perspective, did it mm-hmm. give you extra money to deal with, you know, the expenses of setting up a new flat in a new place?
Yeah.
Or was that just part of your PhD stipend?
Yeah, so I think it fully covered the mobility of everything that we had to do. So that was also really nice because you, as a student, can 100% focus on the project alone and what the project needed and all of the other logistics, part of that. But for example, if you're not part of the Mercury system, but if you were a PhD student at Aarhus University, it's also mandatory to spend some time abroad. In this case, I think there isn't, this kind of mobility to help with the finances unless you apply for a grant. But then, of course, you need to spend the time to, write it and stuff. So I think, with the Mercury covering all the expenses, it was really nice that we could just 100% focus on or not have to worry about the other stuff.
Yeah, go ahead, Masahiro.
So I said the Japanese government now pushing the project. So I'm now using the project named Aspire from the Japanese government. So that is a bit different from probably the Marie Curie program. So that program is supporting the project between the two of the more the laboratories, not the person. So the Japanese laboratories and other countries' laboratories collaborate and make a new project, and the Japanese government supports the Japanese laboratories, and the other countries also support the laboratories. So they're making the new project, and then we can send the student and the postdoc each other, and make the international collaboration and do the large level, high level research between the two countries. So that can support almost everything, including the laboratory, the staff works, and also the hiring the postdoc. And also we can support the expense for the staying the counterpart countries. So that is also a very good opportunity for especially the early career researchers.
And this program, you said it's laboratory to laboratory. So the idea is that you send multiple students over time between the labs. Is that the idea? Mm. Yeah. And Quentin, you had something as well?
One thing that I do see, I really like that what Emily said, that Marie Curie and your university has fundings sometimes for PhD students to move abroad. I've seen a lot of PhD programs that don't have that, but still have that mandatory 3 months or 6 months abroad. And that can be a financial burden, I think, on a lot of students. Now that I'm starting soon as a PI, I'm also looking into small grants that can fund the exchange for students from somewhere else to come and work with me. That also helps getting things started and everything. And there are quite a few that exist, but I think most of it cover only the cost of that PhD student or postdoc moving abroad. And there's very little fund for just doing the research. And that might discourage a lot of PIs to apply to these grants, because in the end, it's great that you get someone that kind of comes and works for free. But if you don't have the funds to actually help them do the work in the lab, then that's basically a waste of time from a point of view. That's something for policymakers, right? To make funding schemes a little bit more appealing to PIs, I would say, specifically for that. Yeah.
How large do each of these grants need to be? Like, how much would you say it costs to bring in a student versus how much does it cost to have somebody do research in your lab for 3 months?
The ones that I've seen, the cost of relocation of the student is actually like basically good for accommodation, flights, and all of that. That covers basically everything. But then you get, there's one specifically that I was looking at this week that gives you €1,000 for funds to work in the lab, to fund a 3 or 6 month stay of a student that will be highly motivated to do a lot of work and to actually expand their research horizon. That's not much. That doesn't go a long distance.
Yeah, €1,000 is what, one DNA origami, if that?
Basically.
But so basically you can move a student for on the order of €1,000, a couple thousand euros.
Yeah, at least from a French point of view, there are agreements between France and a lot of countries. There are some with Canada. I know they have the JSPS agreements with Japan as well, and many other countries, which is really cool to have, but probably a little bit too suboptimal for to be really valuable.
Mm-hmm. But kind of the... So what I'm getting here is it's relatively cheap to move a student from place to place, but the funding for the laboratory work the student's going to do is something that is more at the scale of like the larger grants.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Let's hear from Ibuki next.
Maybe I have a similar question. Like, is there many small funding in a chance for small funding in Europe, like for short internship student, like for PhD student or postdoc, we can of course always apply for a big grant and hire them. But for a short term, in Japan, we don't have much opportunity. And sometimes there was a European student asking for an internship doing Japan. Always the funding become a problem. Like, buying some experimental stuff, it's okay. I can just buy other funding because it's part of research, but paying for the flight or airplane ticket is also not cheap from Europe to Japan. So that kind of funding always limit at least me. There was one person from United States who used a Fulbright program. So that actually was a very good program. They covered all the spending for her. So that was, I found, a very good one. But I mean, the number of opportunities is not very big. So I'm just wondering how people are managing this program, I think.
Yeah, I mean, so in the US, the Fulbright is explicitly for this, to either bring somebody in from abroad or to send somebody abroad. But the thing about the Fulbright is that it's really across disciplines. Like, you can do Fulbrights in literature. It's not just a science mechanism. So the number of people in that pool is relatively large, and the number of grants is also relatively large. In both the US and Europe, I've seen a number of grant applications on the order of maybe 5K to 20K that are kind of meant to supplement an existing appointment. So basically the idea is you already have a salary from a university or something, but you can use these grants to essentially fund one project of your choosing. And the idea is that they're often kind of a bridge to independence for postdocs, is often what they're marketed as. Of, okay, here's some money. You can do one project that is like on your own. You can use it to travel. You can use it to buy reagents. And there's a lot of flexibility in what those grants allow you to do. This initiative is really being organized by the Molecular Programming Society to give ideas for what the next 10 years in the field should look like. If MPS or ISINTS was to put together some sort of funding or support mechanism for student exchanges or sabbatical support, what do you think that should look like? Like, what kind of grant should we have? Who should get it? And what should it cover? Any ideas there? Go ahead, Quentin.
Yeah, maybe going back to what I was mentioning before, bridging the gap between experimentalists and theoreticians. That's something that is, I think, fundamental for the molecular programming field, and something that we maybe don't do enough. So that would be something to really look for and fund in priority, in my opinion, for the field in general and also for the students involved to kind of get both sides of that field, that would be very beneficial.
Go ahead, Ibuki.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. Like, I think this more people are making this textbook about molecular programming, so that, I mean, people from theory side and experiment side can, like, as he said, Quentin said, like, we are doing similar research, but we are using different language. But this kind of textbook basically really helps understanding each other. I guess if there's also some like technical workshop, we can also not just read a textbook, but do something online together, or of course in person, it will be better. Would give or exchange the knowledge, and that can be done by an initiative of this essence or more big.
Is there anything that you would really like to see as a workshop, like a specific topic that you want to see workshops on?
Me personally, like,
yeah.
I have been doing DNA computing, so I have been using DNA as a material, but I'm originally a computer scientist, so I don't have like knowledge like organic chemistry or more chemistry or biology side. So, but you know, like people are start using proteins. So like, I think finding some hybrid of them, and I already start using like alpha fold and things like that. But, you know, I'm kind of newbie to this field. So, but some people already have that kind of knowledge. So I'd like to learn such stuff. Of course, I can always offer my DNA computing skills and knowledge to teach. But, you know, we are always shy how we can start this kind of workshop. So if there's some initiative or, I don't know, some suggestion to start with, it will be very helpful, I think.
Is there any software that your group uses that you wish had a larger community or better stewardship? And what would you like to see the community provide as far as like the tools that your lab is using? Go ahead, Quentin.
From my side, I'm very illiterate about softwares and all theoretical work around DNA nanotech and molecular programming. And that's something that I've tried multiple times to get myself into, but that I basically hit a wall really fast of, okay, things are quite complicated to learn and to just grasp concepts. So something that I would love to see is something extremely user-friendly for someone like me who has no idea what they're doing when they're trying to simulate some DNA structure in general.
I think you also have the particular problem that when you guys are adding interesting chemistries to DNA, mm-hmm. you know, the models are for DNA, not yeah. for DNA with weird stuff on it. And this actually runs into a really like fundamental problem with software there that I would love to see some sort of solution to. I can tell you that one of the groups that I'm a part of is a molecular dynamics group. And one of the things that they are working on is how do we make better force fields for arbitrary molecules rather than like focusing on force fields for DNA, for proteins, for RNA that then aren't so flexible. Like obviously MD is something that's relatively complicated to get into and you need some expertise to run the models and analyze the data. But this ability to expand beyond the kind of common molecules is something that I'm hoping we see more of kind of from a technical perspective in the future, but that's definitely like a future project. Go ahead, Ibuki.
That's a very good point. And I agree that if there's a very good user-friendly super tool that can solve all the theoretical or simulation work, that's ideal, I think. But at the moment, there are many small softwares, I mean, in my opinion, that can, each program or each software can tackle one aspect of the molecular programming field, but they are not really interconnected at a higher level, or maybe our society should somehow push such a direction to have a better software. I mean, there's, as you say, some DNA, some molecular dynamics or coarse-grained molecular dynamics is used only for DNA, some are for proteins, some are for maybe lipids or sugars, or maybe other DNA computing simulation are doing mass reaction level simulation. They are also apart. I don't know. It's all of them are very good. And as a computer scientist, I use the better one at each point. But I agree that all the it's not always friendly for all the theoreticians. I'm not sure what is the best way to. I know some people want to keep their software very sharpened and try not to merge with other software. So that's also a good opinion. I'm not sure what is the best way, but I hope there's one good direction that is suggested by the 10 years, the workshop next week.
Can you think of any specific examples of like two softwares that you really wish, I wish these two were one software that could talk to each other?
For example, the coarse-grained molecular dynamics, we have all atomic molecular dynamics, we have oxDNA, this mRDNA or Snoopy stuff. They are always good in their level of abstraction, but sometimes it's not always easy to communicate each other. Sometimes there are communication tools or one transferring one data set to other data, but it's always not perfect. And they are still each molecular level, each like single molecule level simulation. But as a person doing DNA computing, sometimes you also want to connect them with a mass reaction type, this DSD stuff simulation. Of course, they are very different level of abstraction. So it's not easy to merge or to have a connection between them. But I kind of dream of somebody would come up with a very genius idea for the community of us.
I mean, the multi-resolution simulations are after my heart, right? I really want to see better, you know, abstraction of DNA structure. So I don't know, maybe if I get a group leader grant, we can talk more about this. So we've been talking a lot about collaboration here. And collaboration is a very high commitment. We're going to maybe like send people physically to a place. We're going to write papers together. We're going to like form some sort of relationship that is long in time and costs a lot of money and resources to achieve. But we're also, you know, we're part of a community. And what makes communities are kind of these low touch, short interactions that make people feel like they're part of a larger thing. And one thing I've noticed is that our community lacks a really good way to do kind of low commitment collaboration and communication. We have a number of Slack channels. So I run one in the form of MolePigs. The Molecular Programming Society has a Slack channel. There's a message board on the ITSITS website. And in each of these places, you get people kind of asking questions and trying to crowdsource community knowledge. And people find these really useful. Like, you can get some like really good analysis of why your gels are bad. You can ask really theoretical questions about why is DNA like this. But part of the problem here is that not everybody sees these messages. Not everybody has access to these message boards. Not everybody knows they exist. And so my question is, what do you guys think we can do as a community such that we pool in, you know, a smaller number of places and more of us are able to find these tools? Such that we really do feel like we're part of a molecular programming community where people know each other, talk to each other, share ideas. Any thoughts on that?
Like that Slack is for praise for asking more, I don't know, international question. Like, of course, I understand it's always welcome to ask a very tiny, low-level question, but that kind of question I just personally ask to who I know already. I wonder how other people are doing or thinking how to behave in such a big Slack or international Slack. Mm-hmm. Maybe Emily can.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I'm not a part of the Slacks, but I didn't realize you could ask questions like this on there. And if, like, you know, like maybe I should use it more if I can get such help. So I think having something that can reach more people would be really nice. I'm not sure what that would look like, but for sure, I think it would be a super nice thing.
Mm-hmm. I guess the other thing I should mention is that like there's a few people on Blue Sky trying to replicate old science Twitter. But our community was never particularly active on Twitter, even at, you know, the heyday of science Twitter. You got people posting, you know, their new paper, but you didn't have any accounts that were like the popular molecular programming account, like posting hot takes. There's one guy from another university in Denmark who's been posting a newsletter, and he's kind of the most consistent poster these days. But it's not, again, it's not like a high population community that's there. So one thing that has come up in the past is Lulu Chen talked to MolePigs once about having this idea of like a MolePigs ambassador, like somebody in each lab whose job it is to know what the community is up to, and then be able to disseminate that idea, be able to disseminate community events, community communication options, like through to their community. But again, this was something we've kind of talked to people at conferences about, and we haven't found anybody who is interested in being that person. So it's challenging. Like Ibuki kind of brought up, like, how do you use these tools without being annoying? But also, you know, there's valuable experience there to be had and to be found. I'm not sure what the balance is. Go ahead, Ibuki.
So the balance is not very simple. At least for me, sometimes I know I understand it will be easy to ask, and somebody must know the answer. So, but yeah, that's just like some barrier, a mental barrier to ask, like because many people are looking that, maybe I'm asking to low level questions.
Oh, I'm always terrified of that. As like a pitch for the MolePigs channel, I was having a discussion with one of my PhD students recently, and we were talking about like, you know, why does DNA origami work and other DNA assembly methods don't? And I ended up like not having a super good answer. And so I blasted it into the MolePigs Slack, and I was a little worried like this, people are going to think I'm an idiot for asking this. And it ended up spawning a really good discussion. Yeah. And Dave Doty came in and just like knowledge dumped a multi-paragraph response that I understand why self-assembly works much better now after reading this. But it's something that he never would have been inspired to write that if I hadn't asked the question.
Yeah, if there's some, I don't know, if there's some, I don't know, rule or maybe this Invista system or something to lower the barrier that will make our community more active. Twitter can be also one solution. I'm not pretty in, but...
I mean, I'm against Twitter specifically as a platform these days, but like I said, I've been using Blue Sky, but I have not seen very much activity from our specific community on there. I can talk to as many zoologists as I want, though. That's pretty cool. So let's kind of wrap this up. Does anybody have any final thoughts on what collaborations you'd like to see in the future? What collaborations you'd like to structure in the future? What do the next 10 years look like as far as your collaborations go? Let's start with Ibuki.
In terms of collaboration, so for next, I'm not sure about 10 years, but to having a big project, it's very good to start from short internship and going forward to this PhD position or postdoc position. Of course, if we see in person, we can always try to recruit or try to ask if I can stay abroad. But if the community can support such a interconnection between, especially Japan, physically apart from Europe and United States. So I wish if there's some more opportunity, like if I go to conference, I always there's a chance to talk in person, so that's always good. But I think the community is trying for next 10 years to making it bigger, so this international culture-wise and discipline-wise interaction would be very good.
Maybe I'll call on Quentin next, since you're about to start. Who are you going to try to collaborate with? What are you going to want to work on?
That's the big question, right? The honest answer would be whatever gets funding these days, but that's not not really the way to go. Now, I'm trying to like really ask questions on biology with DNA nanotech and like self-assembled structures based not on DNA base pairing but other supramolecular interactions. So it's really a mix of everything. The chemistry, we've kind of figured out how to make things. We don't really understand how to control the things that we make. So this aspect will be really important, whether it is in terms of morphology, of size, and of things like that, because it's new chemical structures that don't have really a set of rules that is set in stone. So just understanding all of these through like synthetic chemistry, through interaction with biology, and through hopefully also collaboration with theoreticians to better understand all that is going on. That would be the dream in 10 years, but long way to go.
Let's go to Masahiro next.
So I agree with the Ibuki and Quentin's idea. So I'm not a theorist, so I'm not so sure about the theoretical research, but I would like to know. So when the students are in the early career stage, that they have a short internship between the experimental research laboratories and the theoretical research laboratories, maybe we can make the new stage of the molecular programming research probably. So such a the interdisciplinary the internship should be enhanced in the next 10 years probably. But now that we have the many research laboratories, they focuses on each the experiment or theories, but the mixing of those research topics should be created probably.
And finally, let's hear from Emily.
So I think that's a difficult question to answer, but I just know, throughout my PhD, I had a handful of collaborations and I really enjoyed them. I think it really helped, expand my knowledge and hopefully expand whoever I was collaborating with their knowledge as well. And I think this is a really important thing. So I guess I just hope that this keeps on, keep going in the future for many different students across many different universities and countries. And that there is some kind of help to facilitate them.
Great, thank you. Go ahead, Ibuki.
Can I just add just one comment? Or I guess already all the people are aware of, but in our field, if you say experimentalists, people are doing DNA or chemistry or biology related experiment, and if you say theoretician or theory people, it's more like software, making software or doing simulation or physics simulations or more computer mathematics. But I think nowadays this field of AI is also become very big. And is there any plan to also try to collaborate with those people? Like if you see the field of protein engineering or protein design, they have become very big by support of this AI related. I think this is also related to software, I guess, but to not to be left behind, like to not our field to be left behind. I guess if there's some direction, who is taking the initiative to this direction would be, I guess, strategically important, in my opinion.
I mean, so I used to think that our field kind of didn't have enough training data to do cool AI stuff that wasn't something that was built on a foundation model kind of from another field. But there was a poster at FNano this year from Dongyang Kim's lab over in Seoul, where they did completely like diffusion model DNA origami generation. And I am blown away that that worked. So it's coming. Well, thank you everybody for coming. It's been really great talking to you. And also thank you to everybody who listened along to the podcast. The MPS Decadal Flight Plan Initiative is an initiative by our community for our community. So if there's something you heard in here that you want to see expanded on, that you really want us to emphasize, let us know. Either bring it up at the meeting if you're going, or talk to us in one of these Slack channels, or send me an email, and we'll try to get it into the output from the committee meetings such that the whole community has an opportunity to benefit from your perspectives and your expertise. And we will be releasing another one of these tomorrow with the other half of the panel, including the panelists from the Americas and the rest of the European panelists. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.